Ever feel like your WordPress site is moving in slow motion? Switch to Kinsta's Managed Hosting for WordPress and watch it fly. Host your site on Google Cloud's fastest servers with worldwide data centers so your pages load instantly. Need help? WordPress experts respond in under 2 minutes and will migrate to your site for free. Try it yourself. First month free at Kinsta.com. That's Kinsta.com. Kinsta. Simply better hosting.
Look, if you're still buying weed from some guy named Trevor in a parking lot, you're doing it wrong. Mood.com delivers legal THC products straight to your door. Gummies, vapes, flower, the good stuff. No sketchy DMs, no med card. Just add to cart, check out, and boom, it's at your doorstep. It's legal in all 50 states thanks to the Farm Bill, and Mood's products actually work. Seriously, this isn't gas station garbage. It's small batch, lab tested, real results. Go to mood.com, use code FIRST20 for 20% off, and never run dry again. That's mood.com. Go get lit, legally.
Hello, everybody. It's John Pollock, and this is a special preview of our monthly book club show that I do alongside Neil Flanagan. Each month, we sit down, we read a book, and then we discuss. This month, we are giving you a special preview of our last review, which covered the book Hitman by Bret the Hitman Hart. This came out in 2007. It's largely regarded as one of the better wrestling autobiographies in that Bret was keeping active audio recordings like an audio journal throughout his career. So that really informs a lot of the stories and recollections. So here it is. It's a preview. If you want the full edition of the show, you can sign up for our double double or espresso level at postwrestlingcafe.com. It is the return of Book Club. I am John Pollock, and I'm joined by my reading pal, Neil Flanagan, who is here once again. I think we're undertaking our lengthiest tome, so to speak, clocking it at a nice 550 pages. It is Hitman, My Real Life in the Cartoon World of Wrestling by the often outspoken Bret Hart. How are you, Neil? Yeah.
I'm very well, John. Thanks. Doing a little bit better than you going by your voice, but I know that you're still as sharp as ever, even with this cold. So
no, I don't know. I'm kind of dull around the edges, but yes, I'm battling a bit of an illness this week, but set to go.
Can I just say off the top, that expanded title, the cartoon world thing, feels very un-Bret to me. I wonder if that was I don't think he thinks it's a cartoon world, you know, if you read this book. So I wonder if that was a publishing decision. And I think depending on the edition you have, it's sometimes just called Hitman. I think the one I have doesn't have that sort of subtitle, so... Anyway.
So it was released, I want to say it was first released in Canada, and then it got a secondary release through a second publisher in the US. That's my recollection of things, and I don't know if there was any differentiation between them. And an interesting story is that when I worked at the Fight Network, which was a TV network in Canada, they were working with Bret throughout the years. He was kind of in, you know, he was just, you know, pitching different projects, working with the network and whatnot. And the president of our company was kind of the person that dealt a lot with Bret. And when Bret was in, like, he had been working on this book for years and years. And the early discussions were this was going to be like a multi-volume series because of so many notes he had taken and how much you can certainly read this book. And I'm sure, Neil, you could see like the way it's broken up. You could have done a whole book just on pre-WWF with the Stampede and growing up as a member of this Hart family. You could do a whole one on WWF and you could have done a volume post-WWF.
Yeah.
But they combined it. So at some point in there, Bret's manuscript was handed over to the president of our network, and I was not allowed to see this despite some of my best tries, but for like months, it was just sitting there in this guy's office, like Bret's manuscript that I imagine was the more even expanded version than what we finally saw. But I did not get my eyes on that transcript, but this was the final release of Bret Hart's book, which... first of all, like this is one that, as we've mentioned, it's backed by the fact that Bret is one of the few, he kept audio diaries in real time throughout his career. And I mean, Bret is like, whatever you want to say, like he is pretty damn factual when it comes to dates and series of events. You may differ with his opinions, but he is going on a timeline that pretty well holds up to scrutiny and fact checking. And I thought that, like, it really does make for, like, I think getting things right out there. I think this is one of the top tier wrestling books for a lot of different reasons, not the least of which is the era of which he is dissecting, that we've never seen, like, I think, this level of insight into from someone that was in the thick of it in that 90s period in the WWF.
He says very early in the book, you know, his sort of mission statement almost is to sort of guide the reader through his eyes. And he certainly does that. And it put me in mind of kind of this era of professional wrestling, very much like the kind of old school rock and roll touring where, you know, the band, the lead singer has to check which town they're in. And I imagine that's what it was like for most of the talent. Bret had this great advantage of having this recorder with him everywhere. So he had this incredible resource of being able to go back to a particular date and tell you exactly what happens. And the granular detail in this book is pretty amazing. And I suspect, you know, it could have been a multi-volume work. I do wonder what the final volume would have been like. It's the final part of this book is not really a crowd pleaser. It's not the most uplifting.
No, it's just one thing after the other. Like, it's like part three of this book is just the whole world has come crumbling down on Bret. And as much as people might minimize, you know, in the grand scheme of things where Montreal is, like, this was a traumatic event for Bret. And then it is just Owen's death, his stroke, just everything in WCW is just a disaster for Bret. And I find the saddest is just all the infighting in the family and how public it is, like, especially in Canada, where this family does get a lot of coverage. Like, when all that stuff was going on, it's being played out in the papers, and it's just, it comes across, it's so sad, especially for Stu and Helen, who you look at as, you know, fairly grounded people who have seen their family just totally warped by this industry that was both their livelihood and their undoing at the same time. Like, I could certainly see you. I do remember an interview towards the end of Helen's life, and she spoke about kind of that I'm paraphrasing, but something to the effect that, like, wrestling was what they was what gave them their lives, but if she could do it all over again, like, regretting even getting involved in wrestling, if they could have just had a regular life away from this industry that tore so many of them apart. And it's like bitter feuds among these siblings that you see playing out, and that Bret does not bite his tongue on either when it comes to the family members that he went to war against. And I mean, even himself painting himself not always in a favorable light.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think honesty is one of the great is one of the words you could certainly ascribe to this book. I mean, you talked about it being up in the upper tier, and I think that's a very widely held view by people who've read this book. And I think I agree with that. And not only as a wrestling volume, but just as an autobiography, it's so detailed. And I think, again, that all goes back to the source material that he was documenting this as it went, right from his 20s and from one of the most interesting periods, from the death of the territories, which we covered in our last episode. We see that here with Stampede being taken over by WWF. And, you know, that's where Bret gets his start. Right through to the sort of, you know, mass global thing, you know, SummerSlam being in London, all of that kind of it going into a worldwide entertainment.
Do you think you need to be a wrestling fan or have any understanding of pro wrestling beyond the periphery to be engaged in this book?
I don't really think so. I think I could recommend this to people I know who would be interested, just telling them this is one of the more interesting characters in any field of entertainment or sports that you're going to encounter. Mm-hmm. His voice is very authentic throughout this. I think you've interviewed and met the man several times. So, I mean, you can speak to that better than I can, but
no, this reads as Bret. Yeah. I don't have any knowledge of, like, a ghostwriter that worked on this with him. I mean, it's like Bret is, He's a very polished writer, and he's also someone that has like quite a fascination with, you can see like of, you know, Civil War history, and you know, you just you see when he would go to foreign countries and what he would explore on his time. And I find it interesting as well, like it's a very small piece of his story, but going to film school, that I think there was something definitely born and bred in those years when it came to trying to be a storyteller, and how that informed a lot of his match construction, and even being involved in booking at a very young age in Stampede, when he kind of the book got swapped between him and Bruce, that, you know, he had a very, I think, like vivid mind that made for a medium in pro wrestling that lends itself well to that form of storytelling. And I think that extended here to just the way he is with words and in terms of analogies. Like he's a very skilled writer, and I'm sure he had some, you know, talented editors overseeing this as well, but this very much nails the voice of Bret Hart, if you're familiar with him.
Absolutely. Yeah. He does credit an editor whose name, I'm sorry, escapes me at the minute, but at some point in the book. But
you poor editors, you never get the right pat on the back.
Well, I mean, all authors, you know, from the absolute greats, you know, have great editors too. So, but yes, I would recommend the book to somebody who's unfamiliar with wrestling, because he's such a fascinating figure.
Is this your first time reading this book?
No, I read it not too long after it was released in the UK, which, I mean, I think was fairly shortly after. Like you said, I think it came out in Canada first.
It was then around 07 it came out here that I
read. Yeah, it's going to be 08 or 09 when I read it. And I was quite keen to read it. So I remember, even though that's, you know, whatever, many teen years ago, being keen to get my hands on it. I only read it the once. And we'll maybe get into this. And I think that was because really by the end, I was somewhat fatigued by the book, particularly the parade of negative things that happen in Bret's life in the final section of the book. And also, I'm going to just say this, you know, some of the sort of egotism began to wear a little bit by the end as well. You know, he cannot let the Sean thing go, for example. It becomes redundant after a while. A number of times he's like, you know.
It struck me that is how the book ends with the epilogue. And it's just, I can never forgive Sean and Hunter for destroying this business. I was like, that's the end point of this 550 page book, is on that. Listen, I mean, that is both the charm and the criticism of Bret Hart. The man has a big ego. But I think it's one that is also, when you hold it up on the pantheon, it's one that he is very well respected. Like if there's someone that's going to have a large ego, he's going to be one of those people that can command it. And he, I don't always agree with all of his opinions, but I never listen to him. And I'm just saying, like, this is totally, like, this guy's just full of it, or that he's just making stuff up out of nowhere. He's not political. He is not tap dancing around topics. And some people find that really refreshing. And I would include myself, like, in an industry where everyone is always careful about who they offend or being in good standing, Bret has never been a guilty party to that criticism.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it goes back, in my case, to him being one of my favorites, you know, whenever WWF programming started being shown on this side of the Atlantic. I mean, and another that he gives a lot of praise to, Kurt Hennig, was kind of the first guy I really latched onto and thought, I like this style probably more so. And I was a bit older than a lot of the real kids who were seeing it on Sky for the first time. But the sort of Hulkamania never chimed with me. I enjoyed the real technicians in the ring. And that, for me, that was first, it was Mr. Perfect and then Bret. So I was a big fan. So that was also something that fed into, you know, an interest in this man, you know, and his public pronouncements. And I agree with you that there's no bullshit, there's no politics, there's no soft soaping stuff. He says what he means, and if you're a Ric Flair fan who disagrees with him, and you don't even need to be a fan, just an impartial observer of the business, I still don't doubt for a second that Brett isn't just getting digs in for the sake of it. He really thinks that Rick is overrated, that Rick was, I think it's, he says something along the lines of a non-stop non-psychology, you know, in his matches, just spots that don't make sense.
A routine man.
A routine man, yeah.
As his father would say. Yeah, I mean, listen, and there's times in this book, Brett does not come off, I think, glowingly at times. And maybe even that's not maybe his intent, but I could, like, there's plenty of times in this book that I had a lot of sympathy for his wife, Julie. And you know, his, you know, and that is this constant struggle in his life is maintaining this marriage while he's out on the road, and he is not shy about all of his extramarital affairs on the road and sleeping with all these women, and that he's lonely. And it's almost like, I don't know, it's almost Brett trying to convey sympathy on his plight. And I don't know how you necessarily achieve that with too many readers. Like, some will understand that, but at the other hand is, here is your wife that is at home, you know, raising your kids at a time when these individuals were never at home because of the insane schedule on top of it.
It's kind of sad, you know, because in the early chapters where he meets Julie, and you know, it seems great, and the kids come along. And then again, just this brutal honesty about, you know, this was his coping mechanism on the road at a time when he was maybe wrestling 300 matches a year. And that's not a Hoganism or a Flairism. It's real. And thank God that sort of schedule is in the past nowadays, because he's open about that was his coping mechanism. Was, I think he says, his lust was always stronger than his guilt. He doesn't.
And he admits to feeling like that guilt. But yeah, you're right. Like, it ultimately wins out. And his argument is that, you know, and believe me, I do have sympathy for what these guys had to go through schedule wise, and that, you know, my vices were not alcohol. They weren't drugs. He's open about steroid use and such, but he's like, I never became like a pill guy or hard drugs or an alcoholic on the road. My vice was women. And I guess if you're going to look at it through that prism, through that reality, he chose the lesser of the evils in terms of like what was going to, you know, produce a body count at the end of this for a lot of these guys who would either be not able to live past a certain age, or were going to be handicapped by these vices for the rest of their lives.
Which is another theme in the book that he returns to. You know, I think even as early as the preface, he talks about one more for the list, and it won't be the last. And he's talking about early deaths. You know, and there's a litany of them here: Pillman, Owen,
the picture of Dynamite, who has not died by the time this book is written, but is like, his career is over by his early 30s, and he is wheelchair bound. Like, he is presented in this as the ultimate wrestling tragedy. Like, here was someone that Brett regarded as potentially the greatest wrestler he had ever worked with, and this guy was a footnote in terms of, you know, where, like, people are familiar with the name the Dynamite Kid, but I think he's looked at much more of a wrestling tragedy than a prodigy.
Definitely, and I think it's one of the more interesting parts of the section of the book that gets into early WWF days, is that the British Bulldogs, plural, are the faces, and, you know, the Hart Foundation are the heels. But that, I mean, I don't remember seeing that on TV at all. It sort of predates my time as a fan. I'm not sure you can readily find a lot of that stuff. I'm sure you can, but it's not something that's part of my memory as a wrestling fan. So, yeah, Billington is, I know, much more as kind of this tragic figure almost, rather than, you know, what he was like in his heyday.
Look, if you're still buying weed from some guy named Trevor in a parking lot, you're doing it wrong. Mood.com delivers legal THC products straight to your door. Gummies, vapes, flower, the good stuff. No sketchy DMs, no med card. Just add to cart, check out, and boom, it's at your doorstep. It's legal in all 50 states, thanks to the Farm Bill, and Mood's products actually work. Seriously, this isn't gas station garbage. It's small batch, lab tested, real results. Go to mood.com, use code FIRST20 for 20% off, and never run dry again. That's mood.com. Go get lit, legally.
On the Post Wrestling Cafe this month, John Pollock and Wei Ting sit down for a new edition of Talk. We are also going back to 1992 to look at the G1 climax from that year. Rich Van and W.H. Park are getting together to review Peacemaker Season 2 and look at Marvel Zombies. Plus, we have Book Club detailing Kamala Harris's new release, 107 Days, weekly editions of Collision Course, and the XL versions of Rewind to Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown. All can be found at postwrestlingcafe.com. The book, I did isolate several excerpts from the book just to give the listener a sense of the writing here. Right near the beginning, he writes, "I am a survivor with a story to tell. There's never been an accurate account of the history of pro wrestling. All the public knows is what is packaged and sold to them by the industry. Since I'm no longer in the business, I'm in a decent position to tell the truth without fear of recrimination. With this book, which is based on the audio diary I kept through all my years in wrestling, starting in my early 20s, I want to put you in my shoes so you can experience what pro wrestling was like in my era, through my eyes. It's not my intention to take needless jabs at those who made the journey with me, but I'll pull no punches either. Not here. Wrestling was never my dream, and all too often, it was my nightmare. Yet ingrained in me from birth was the instinct to defend it like a religion. For as long as I can remember, my world has been filled with liars and bullshitters, losers and con men. But I've also seen the good side of pro wrestling. To me, there is something beautiful about a brotherhood of big, tough men who only pretend to hurt one another for a living." And that kind of summarizes kind of Brett's approach to all of this. And maybe a few needless jabs that were
there are a few. Whether they're needless or not, I suppose, is in his the eye of this beholder, as you know, Brett himself. But yes, there are certainly quite a few jabs throughout this book, and actually, that's one of the more entertaining things about it, I find, because it's just this this unflinching honesty of the man. He's not going to soft soap his opinions. He's got firm opinions, and he's going to let you know what they are.
Have you ever read Dynamite Kid's book?
I have not.
Okay, maybe that's a future one, but his is also like pretty unapologetic regarding like those. But I mean, in a less artistic way than maybe Brett's writing is, Dynamite would just write on and on about a certain person, and then it'd be like, period, prick. And that would be how he summarized a prick. And that is how he would go through things. But I think it's worth, we're kind of going to go in various directions on this, but I think at the core is this family that is the Harts, with Stu and Helen having 12 children, all of which in some form or fashion get attached to pro wrestling, whether marrying wrestlers, getting into the industry. I mean, they all have, like, this is the family business. And of course, Brett becomes the biggest star of the family, him and Owen to a degree as well. But you really get an insight to Brett where I think you have to make that decision when you're doing a book like this. Like, is anyone going to be spared that are my blood relatives? And the answer was an unequivocal no. No one would be spared here. And you just got, like, literally Brett, you know, just talking about, you know, what, like, here we have him discussing Smith, his oldest brother, lacked the drive to put in a real effort. He squandered every chance my parents gave him. He would just go on and just go one by one, like the positives of one brother, the negatives of another. And this just mounts throughout the book. And then it really culminates after Owen's death. And you get this stark divide within the family where there are siblings that want to ingratiate themselves to Vince McMahon for their husbands to have jobs. They have others that side with Brett and others that are neutral. But it's just from the get-go, you see the upbringing here and the both the love of the siblings, but also divides among them, which maybe in a family of you have 11 siblings, there is going to be those natural kind of dividing lines.
Yeah, there's even right from the get-go, there's a rather sad sort of note in there where he says, you know, he's been hurt and betrayed by some of my brothers and sisters, yet I don't think I've ever let them down. Again, there's perhaps a bit of Brett's famous ego in there. But he goes on to say, the truth is my family knows very little about me, which I find, you know, one of the real, you know, standout lines in this book. It's just so interesting that clearly in this big house that he grew up in with Stu, who was this incredible disciplinarian. In fact, he talks about his dad as two separate people almost. I think he says Stu was the guy he was shit scared of. It's not the words he used, but it's to that effect, where dad was the guy that he loved. And that feeds into the whole pro wrestling aspect, I think. You know, Brett later talks about the various aspects. You know, is he the hitman, the guy in the ring? Is he the family man? Is he? He's all of these things. It speaks to how complicated, I think, particularly at this time where kayfabe is still a thing, particularly where he's starting out, not within the Hart household, but as part of the industry, where there's this sort of identity crisis. And you see it, to go outside the realms of the book a wee bit, you see it still, I think, with some of the old timers. You know, when you see a Sergeant Slaughter turn up at a Hall of Fame and he's in the, you know, he's pretty much in character. When you see a Gangrel whose wrestling days are long behind him, but he's still basically in character when he shows up at conventions and so on, has the teeth and the slick back hair and all of that. I think there's just an element where these guys never leave the gimmick behind.
They lived it 24/7, and that was ingrained in them, and it was just, it became just their identity, and it got lost. The individual got lost in the character, and I think you saw so much of that from those characters, especially in the 80s, where I do think you have a much more grounded set of performers today that are, can at least decipher that a bit better, with some exceptions. But you know, you look at it from the perspective of these little kids who, you know, Brett is talking about how fearful he was of like Archie the Stomper Gouldy threatening to come after Stu and then showing up at their house, and what you're exposed to. And this is delved into in the Wrestling with Shadows documentary, like Stu stretching these guys in the basement and hearing these god awful screams and guys being tortured there, and what impact that has. You know, it's just, it's not a normal childhood that you're growing up in. And I almost like it's touched upon, but you also have just the waves of this Stampede territory, where they got to experience the excesses when the business was hot, and then they're like in poverty when the territory's on its ass, and going to school where they're being made fun of, where they don't have proper clothing to wear. I mean, there's a lot of scars I think these children had to wear being a member of the wrestling family in Calgary, that they were, I'm sure, targets of a lot of scrutiny, of bullying. And we're talking about, you know, children at the ages that they're experience all of this and being told your father's a fake, having to defend this industry, not probably fully understanding even what your father does, like what this industry even is. I mean, it's a lot for adults to process this industry. Yeah. And it's even more so when we're talking about these kids that I'm sure they were, you know, eventually smartened up, but not initially, and they have to go out into the world, and this is the identity that they're seen as.
Yeah, he talks about that. I think by the time he's in his teens, of course, he's a bit smarter about what the business is and all of that. But this dichotomy of being at school, where he's kind of quiet and so on, but he says the fights are real, whereas when he's working for his dad, he's Joe Cool, I think is the expression he uses. But the fighting is not real, you know. I think I can't imagine what it's like to grow up with 11 siblings. That to me is just, you know, unthinkable. You know, it's unimaginable. But in that,
I'm also balancing two, and that's
But even in that context, of, I suppose, if, what's his name? Mark Briscoe is trying to.
He's not too far away. He could hit 12 by the end of the things.
But not only that, you know, having all of those siblings around and this weird house, but also what's going on in that home, the screams from the basement, the constant visitors and people staying at the house. And one of the things, maybe slightly off, well, it still speaks to his early career, that I didn't know until I read the book. I always assumed that Brett was a through and through dungeon trained wrestler. Just because that's what you assume, you know, you hear about the famous dungeon, it's too hard, Stampede, etc. But first of all, as you mentioned, he had the foray into film school, which was ultimately not the way he went. And I suppose speaks to what he says in the book about it not being his first choice of career. I think he does some comic book stuff as well. It's a very dense book, though, so if I get any of the detail wrong, don't jump on me, listeners. But he's not really trained in the actual art of selling, bumping, tie-ups, all of the sort of stuff that you need to put together to become a great wrestler by his father. That's by two Japanese.
This is Mr. Hito, Mr. Sakurada, that he ends up, training under. Like, they are over from Japan, and Stu kind of instructs them to handle Brett, who was initially going to go to train under Vern Gagne, which would have been interesting because Vern Gagne could have claimed that he produced Brett and Ric Flair.
Yeah.
Maybe Brett would have become a routine man. Which is funny because, like, that would be the criticisms Brett would receive in terms of, like, his closing sequences, that it was, but that in a nutshell is kind of pro wrestling. It's like you introduce these patterns for your audience to jump onto. But I like the film school stuff. I found it really interesting because I do believe that that did play a role in Brett's kind of development and mind for the industry. And you compare it to today, where if you were to make up a curriculum for a pro wrestler, beyond just like taking bumps and doing the physical aspect of it, you would probably want to be as well-rounded as you could. And like, whether it be improv comedy or filmmaking, it's like all these other assets that could be found outside of pro wrestling that could greatly benefit you in today's industry, I think would be of great value. And I don't doubt that this was something that did give Brett a bit of an edge. That, and I think this very brief period where he's booking, where he's talking about writing down all the finishes every night, not repeating finishes. Like, he's learning the art of booking at a very, very young age, which not too many wrestlers of that age are learning booking firsthand in a, I'm not going to call this a major territory, but like a mid-tier territory. And in Canada, like, it covered a lot of like the Western part of Canada.
Yeah. I think he is a true artist. I think that's fair to say. I mean, if wrestling is a performance art, and I believe it is, Brett is one of the greatest exponents of it. And he knows it, you know, as anyone who reads this book will see, you know, the number of times he saves the card by putting on the best match, or he carries a lesser wrestler or somebody who's drunk or recovering from a binge of whatever, you know, to a great match. He's not shy about telling you this, but I think it's largely true, you know, so he has that in his favor. So those who think he's an egotist, and he is, he has some real grounding for saying so. But yeah, and he talks about the artistry of professional wrestling quite a lot. And I think that's what plays into his criticism of other people. Ultimate Warrior is another one, and that's not a unique prospect or perspective on him. You know, that's this guy who was blown up by the time he got to the ring, had like maybe four or five moves, and you know, I think a lot except kids who were just completely enthralled by the look of the guy could see that. But Brett takes that much further, really, into people that are really widely regarded as legends, like Flair, as we've mentioned.
For more of the Bret Hart review, you can go to our Double Double or Espresso tier at postwrestlingcafe.com, and you can get the full entire review of Hitman. Neil Flanagan and I are back next Thursday, and the next subject is going to be 107 Days by Kamala Harris, detailing her 2024 campaign going against Donald Trump. All that can be found at postwrestlingcafe.com. This month at postwrestlingcafe.com, go XL, and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. Postwrestlingcafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.